Do you remember the great kingdoms of Scripture? I think most of us would say, sure, I remember the great kingdoms of Scripture. I remember Babylon. It may have been the case you were in here earlier when Brother Bryant was talking about Babylon. I remember Babylon. I remember Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah. I remember their being there during the captivity. We can also remember Medo-Persia. We can think about Cyrus and Darius and Xerxes or Ahasuerus and other great people associated with that kingdom. We remember the kingdom. We remember the kingdom of Greece. We can think about Paul's ministry in Athens. We can think about even further back some of the prophecies concerning that location. We can remember Rome. We can think again about what Paul faced at the hands of Rome. And we can all remember Carthage. Carthage is somewhere that we certainly as Bible students are familiar with. Wait a second. What is that fifth kingdom? I don't remember that kingdom being mentioned in Scripture. And I'm familiar with Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. I remember the prophecies of those locations. I remember the prophecy of the four kingdoms, of Babylon, of Medo-Persia, of Greece, of Rome, represented by the different animals there in Daniel 7 who came up out of the sea, represented by the different parts of the colossal statue of Daniel chapter 2. What I don't remember is that fifth kingdom that was mentioned. Carthage, by all accounts, could have and should have been number 5. Or should have been number 4, and Rome should have been number 5. For the purpose of our study today, we're going to think about Carthage as number 5. We're going to ask, how close was number 5? What if there had been a number 5? What stopped number 5? We want to consider history revisited, the kingdom that wasn't. Carthage grew larger by insensible degrees, but its dominion was not long confined to Africa. This ambitious city extended her conquests into Europe, invaded Sardinia, made herself mistress of a great part of Sicily, and reduced to her subjection almost the whole of Spain. And having sent out powerful colonies into all quarters, enjoyed the empire of the seas for more than 600 years, and formed a state which was able to dispute preeminence with the greatest empires of the world. Thus, she sounds pretty important. She sounds like she could be number 5. If we look at a map from around 218 BC, around the start of the Second Punic War, we see the land area that was Carthage. Comparing that land area with Italy, we get an idea of her prominence. Even though she had started around the same time as Rome, as basically an outpost for Tyre's queen. She went there and established this trading post on the Mediterranean. Now, I want you to notice the date here. This is 218 BC. This is before the primary event that we want to consider during our lesson this afternoon. 218 BC, she already is that large. She certainly seems like she could have been number 5. Well, there was a boy who was born in Carthage. He was the son of Hamilcar Barca. Hamilcar Barca was an enemy of Rome and the Romans. Well, when Hannibal was a boy of 9, according to Polybius, his father led him by the right hand up to the altar and told him to place his hand on the victim and swear unremitting hatred for the Romans. Son, do me a favor. I want you to always hate Rome. Now, most of us understand that our parents can influence our thoughts to a large degree. Now, Dad was an Alabama fan. He had gotten his doctorate from Alabama. I'm not an Alabama fan, but I hate Auburn, and I hate Florida, and I hate Tennessee, and I hate South Carolina, and I hate Clemson, even though I wish they were in the SEC. Our parents can certainly have an influence on what we like and what we don't like. His father has just made him swear that he will always hate Rome. And I'll go ahead and tell you, he did. He hated Rome till the day of his death. Now this is he, a little older, obviously. What's written here is written concerning written in Polybius, is written concerning something which he said around the year 200. This would have been a time period when he was seeking allies outside of Carthage. The reason being, I'm not going to discuss because I don't want that to take away from the import of the lesson. We'll briefly mention later what happens. But he's seeking allies. And he goes to Antiochus III. I don't know if Eric Owens is in here or not, but if Eric's in here, Antiochus III is the father of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the vile man of the book of Daniel. Antiochus III was one who was a thorn in Rome's side and really tried to do more as a Syrian than really he ought to have tried to do. Hannibal thought, you know what, I need to ally with him. But he was only going to ally with Antiochus III as long as Antiochus was planning to harm the Romans. He, Antiochus, would have him, Hannibal, as his truest ally. But if he ever came to terms with the Romans and became their friend, Antiochus should distrust Hannibal and should be on guard against Hannibal, because Hannibal would do everything in his power to harm the Romans' interests. That is roughly 2 decades after what's the focus of our lesson in a few moments. So keep that in the back of your mind. Losing the connection periodically here, so I apologize for that. You mind flipping the next one, Con? Thank you. Now, Hannibal is going to march against Rome. And inexorable march where he is bound and determined to put an end to that city, to that kingdom. Hannibal is going to popularly go into Spain, cross the Alps. Many of us have heard the stories about Hannibal taking elephants across the Alps. Could you turn to the next slide there, Con, please? It's good to have my boy with me for a number of reasons. Among them, the fact that he makes a great remote control. In the Dictionary of Wars, George Childs Cone says, Hannibal and his forces with about 80 elephants marched rapidly through southern France and across the Alps and invaded northern Italy, precipitating a new war. We see an image there that was drawn sort of commemorating the crossing of the Alps. We'll get back to this thought in a few minutes. But yesterday, I think it was, Brother Wade mentioned having to ride a number of hours with children in the car. That would be nothing compared to trying to ride a number of hours with elephants in the car. Children may be asking, are we there yet? Elephants are going to be demonstrating the whole time their lack of desire to go in the first place. Elephants were, by Hannibal, dragged over the Alps. Not something they naturally would desire themselves to set out to do. He managed to get them to do it. My understanding is elephants are afraid of water to the degree they don't want to be on something that's floating. Well, instead of just trying to load them up on boats, Hannibal said, what we'll do is we'll make boats look like ground. And so he made large barges. These large barges had dirt and grass and trees. He marched the elephants onto those barges and then took them across great rivers. An ingenious man. Not all of the elephants survived. In fact, if we were to look a little bit to the right, we'd see an elephant falling off the Alps. Well, the Alps are narrow when you're an elephant. This march was worded by Juvenal this way. Would you mind turning to the next one, Con? This is the man for whom Africa was too small a continent. Though it stretched from the surf-beaten ocean shores of Morocco east to the steamy Nile to Ethiopian tribesmen and new elephants' habitats. Now Spain swells his empire. Now he surmounts the Pyrenees. He splits the very rocks asunder, moves mountains. Now Italy is his. This is the force that was moving upon Rome. Turn to the next one, please. The Romans were not, according to Cone, prepared for Carthage's large, well-equipped army, which was augmented by Gauls. It wasn't just augmented by Gauls. It was augmented by people from just about every land he had gone through. He had a way of getting people to fight for him, either because of some personal allegiance or because of money. In fact, a large part of his military, as was the case in most lands, was composed of mercenaries. We see on the map here three locations where he's going to engage the Romans. We're going to briefly look at two of those. We'll focus in more detail at the third. Could you move to the next slide, please, Con? This is the first of the engagements that we want to consider. There were a number of smaller ones. But this is the Battle of Trebia. Carthage had 30,000 men going against Rome's 42,000. Now let me say a word before we get too far into the lesson regarding numbers of armies, numbers of soldiers and so forth in ancient records. Those numbers today are questioned pretty thoroughly, partly because we don't necessarily see these numbers on modern battlefields. How could they have gotten these numbers on to ancient battlefields? Probably the one who is most questioned regarding his use of numbers is Herodotus. Herodotus said that there were 5 million soldiers that Xerxes led against Greece. Okay, I could understand maybe there weren't 5 million men in the army of Xerxes. However, you could include in that number those who were support, those who would be making sure that the troops were fed, that luggage was carried, and things of that nature. If you look at modern comparisons between number of people in a nation and number of people in its military, 5 million is not a number that's too far off. The Persian Empire at that time, it's estimated, had somewhere around 50 million people. So Herodotus bringing out 5 million would have only been 10%. Herodotus may have exaggerated somewhat about Xerxes' army, but he says something which illustrates how great the army was. He said, what river did they not drink dry? You've got to have a pretty large army for that to be the case. So that said, 30,000 Carthaginians, some people will question that number. Some people will question a number that there were 42,000 Romans. I think those numbers are pretty close. They're going to be in the ballpark. Let's take for granted that the numbers that we're seeing in the slides that we show are reasonable numbers. Of their 30,000, Carthage only lost around 5,000. Of Rome's 42,000, Rome lost around 30,000. Now that's just the first of the major battles. Would you turn to the next slide, please? Following this battle, roughly a year later, there was the battle at Lake Trasimene. Carthage had 55,000 troops. Now notice that the troop numbers have gone up. What is Hannibal able to do? He's able to find other soldiers. Keep that in mind. He's able to find support to replace soldiers. Now Rome, you are in Roman territory, so they're not going to have a problem raising an army. Rome has 30,000 in this engagement. Of the 55,000, Carthage only lost 2,500. Of the 30,000, Rome lost roughly half. Another decisive victory for Carthage. Would you turn to the next? As Hannibal continued marching, Hannibal seized the Acropolis, the city hill, of a town called Cannae, where the Romans had stored grains and other provisions harvested from around Canusium. If you're looking at the boot that we call Italy, you'll remember that the toe is pointed down this way, the heel is over here, and the boot sort of goes up like this. Rome is on the left side of the boot. Canusium is a region east and maybe a little south of Rome, and it's the breadbasket during that time of Rome. Now we get closer to the time of Christ. Egypt's her breadbasket because of Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, and their relationship with Cleopatra and so forth. But really, that would have started to a degree even before that. But Canusium is the breadbasket of Rome. I want you to keep that in mind. If you can control Cannae, you can control Canusium. Here we have a view, ostensibly from that Acropolis. We want to consider the tell of the tape. What did the armies look like before this battle? Thank you, son. I didn't even tell you to turn it. I was thinking I was turning it on here. Great. Appreciate you, man. The tell of the tape. Carthage brought to this battle 40,000 infantry, 10,000 cavalry, 9,600. No, 10,000. That's right. Rome had the 9,600. Rome brought 80,000 infantry, 9,600 cavalry. The odds are 2-1 in favor of the Romans as this battle is about to take place. That did not inspire fear in the Carthaginians. That did not inspire fear in Hannibal. But that caused the Senate in Rome to shake in her boots. Next slide, please, Con. Did we have two of those? We did. Yeah, I should have deleted the first one. There's another pretty picture for you. All right, here's the Battle of Cannae, the way that it's set up. The blue is Carthage's troops. The red is Rome's troops. You'll notice that Carthage has pushed out the middle a bit there to lull the Romans into a false sense of security. As we go to the next slide, please, Con. We'll get to the battle itself, but we want to consider the pre-game speeches, the locker room speeches, if you will, of these two sides. Now, Aemilius was speaking on the part of the Roman Senate. He was speaking to the Romans. He said, "It is hard, if not impossible, to imagine that after meeting the enemy on equal terms in minor skirmishes and usually winning, we shall lose a full-scale battle when we outnumber the enemy by more than 2-1. All right, he's playing a politician here. We've been winning all the battles. Well, we just saw two where they had it handed to them. Just lopsided defeats. There is a fear behind this. But he's trying to build strength in the minds of his troops. In short, men, there is nothing to stop you winning. All that is needed is your grit and determination. So you have no need of my words, men. But notice this, Rome has exhausted all of her resources. You've got nothing to worry about. We outnumber them 2-1. We're going to have no problem. We've been winning victories all along the way. But, you know, we lose this one. We don't have anything to fall back on. Move to the next slide, please, Con. If this battle does not turn out well, she, Rome, has nothing left with which to prevail over her enemies. She has vested in you all her desires and all her power. All her hopes of survival depend on you. Now, this is written by an ancient historian. It's written by Polybius. A lot of times, the historians would put words, speeches, into the mouths of great characters. Maybe to a degree what's taking place here, but we can understand that Aemilius would have said something along this line. Well, we see the great number of Rome's army there. Rome's going to especially feel confident when she sees the way that the Carthaginians are set up. But that confidence is going to be about like the confidence that he's inspired. It's going to be an uneasy one. Go to the next slide, please, Con. Sorry about that. It works good for you, man. All right. What did Hannibal tell the Carthaginians? Hannibal told the Carthaginians, what we are going to fight for now is control of the cities and all their blessings. We win this battle, we get the goods. Next slide, please. In short order, victory will bring us master of all Italy. We win this battle, Rome is ours. An end to our current troubles and possession of Rome's entire fortune. Let's ask this question. Would Rome's entire fortune include Rome? Yeah, you would think so. This battle will make you lords and masters of the world. Notice the different attitude there. We win this battle, we are top. We win this battle, we are king, Rome is done. Next slide, please. Polybius says tension and terror gripped Rome. At the news that the two armies were encamped close to each other and that clashes were happening on a daily basis, given that they had so often been defeated before, it doesn't sound like what Aemilius said, their prospects seemed grim. Next slide, please, Con. Hannibal at the gates. This was the fear. This would be the realization if Rome lost this battle. Hannibal at the gates. One historian said that today, 2,200 years later, Italians still use this expression. That this expression means that there is a great threat at hand. It could also mean, according to the historian, we've got a client. So, I don't know what the connection is there. Got a client. Hannibal's at the gates. Next slide, please. Juvenal would say in Satire 7, up for discussion. Should Hannibal march on Rome from Cannae? Well, there doesn't seem like much of a discussion, does there? This battle will make us the rulers of Italy, rulers of the world. Of course we're going to march on Rome if we win the battle. Next slide, please, Con. Charles Freeman in his Egypt, Greece, and Rome said the great battle scenes during the war with Hannibal still haunt the reader. Rome has her back against the wall. Next, please, Con. We have accomplished nothing, he, Hannibal, cries, till we have stormed the gates of Rome, till our Carthaginian standard is set in the city's heart. Next slide, please. The battle has commenced. What looked like a weak middle folds in. The Romans charge into that weak middle and are flanked on both sides and from behind by the Numidian cavalry, which you see up top, which having run the Romans off the field of battle, only 300 of that 9,600 cavalry remained, swept around to close the back. So on that day, the Romans were trapped on all sides by these Carthaginians and by the Numidians and by the Spaniards and by the Gauls, and were so tightly packed in this little area that they couldn't fight the enemy. If they did any fighting, it was in confusion against their own numbers. And so on that day, 70,000 of Rome's 89,600, counting the cavalry along with the infantry, 70,000 died. Another 10,000 were captured. My math skills aren't that great, but it looks like Rome's left with about 9,600 from the start of that day. Carthage, on the other hand, lost only roughly a tenth of their soldiers. Next slide, please. Polybius says the Carthaginians even found themselves in a position to anticipate capturing Rome itself in short order. We've won Cannae. All we have to do is head west, and Rome is ours. Next slide, please, Con. And for the Romans, the defeat meant that they immediately gave up any hope of retaining supremacy in Italy and brought them to the point where they were at serious risk of losing their lives and the very soil of their homeland, and where they fearfully expected to do so, since they anticipated Hannibal's arrival at any moment. Remember, Hannibal at the gate. Next slide, please, Con. How close was number five? Number five was that close. But let's ask this. What if there had been a number five? So what? What if there had been a number five? Next slide, please. If there had been a number five, prophecy would have been wrong. If one prophecy is unfulfilled, all Scripture is worthless. If Scripture is worthless, there is no God. Carthage was a day or two's march away from making our being here nothing. In fact, had they gone into Rome, we may not even have a Bible to be here in the first place. But Carthage, if she had defeated Rome, would have put an end to the book of Daniel. Now, I feel sorry for a lot of people. I do. I feel sorry. Wayne's laughing. Wayne can imagine the people I feel sorry for. I feel sorry for athletes on most of my favorite teams. You know, they'll stay there for 15 years and never win anything. And some of them, they even lose the whole team when a team has moved to Oklahoma City. Anyway, we won't talk about that because that's not the forum. But anyway, I feel sorry for people who put in a lot of effort and get no return. Wouldn't it have been great if Griffey Jr. could have won a championship? Wouldn't it have been great if Alex Rodriguez hadn't? You know, we feel sorry for people. I really feel sorry for Hannibal. I love Hannibal. The only thing is, Hannibal wasn't just fighting against the Romans. He was fighting against God. He was fighting against prophecy. Next slide, please. Hannibal did not follow up his victory. He's got plenty of troops. He has the bread basket. Rome sitting there cowering. And he doesn't follow up his victory. Hannibal remained in Italy until 202 BC. That is nearly a decade and a half that he sat in Italy outside of Rome. Not once did he try to attack that city. So we ask this, what stopped number five? Go to the next slide, please. Why did Hannibal not follow up his victory? Was it a lack of resolve from Hannibal? No, remember that he always hated Rome. He hated Rome when he was a child. He hated Rome 20 years after this. You see, he's going to remain in Italy until 202 BC. And the only reason he leaves Italy is because Scipio Africanus has sort of skirted around him, knowing he can't fight him in Italy, has sort of skirted around him, goes down into Carthage so that the Carthaginians say, hey, Hannibal, come back home. We need to have a fight down here. That's the only reason that Hannibal ever left Rome. Now, by that time, the resolve of the Carthaginians was so weakened that he ultimately lost the battle of Zama in North Africa. That's when he fled east and joined up with Antiochus III and then later with another. But his lack of resolve, no, he never stopped hating Rome. Was it the amount of resolve that Rome had? Well, maybe so. Maybe so. I'm not going to completely cross out that possibility. The Roman Senate maybe felt a little too comfortable, but it worked out for them. The Roman Senate, when they were offered those 10,000 captives that had been captured at Carthage, they said, we don't want them. That they have turned on Rome. Well, that's 10,000 soldiers that they turned down that they might could have used. They didn't need them. But in human terms, they might could have used them. I'm not going to say that definitely not there wasn't resolve from Rome. But before the battle, they had already given up any hope. So I don't put a lot of stock in that. How about the lack of supplies? Some people say that Hannibal did not march on Rome because he couldn't get resupplied. Well, the problem with that is manifold, but we'll notice just a couple here. Hannibal was able to stay in Rome in Italy for over a decade. Nearly a decade and a half. He's hanging out in Italy. What's he doing? Starving? No, he's eating. His soldiers are eating. He controls Canusium. He owns the Mediterranean. If they can get food from anywhere throughout the Mediterranean, they can bring food to him. That's not the reason. Was it the lack of troops? No. Remember that second battle, he had more soldiers than he did in the first battle. Why is that? Because he could pay mercenaries. Because he could conscript soldiers. He could have been supplied from Carthage. Now, there is an interesting footnote. The Senate in Carthage said, you know what? He's got it under control. We don't even need to send any soldiers. They could have very easily. Was it the lack of troops? No. Was it the strength of Rome's troops? Well, I don't believe so. Rome could have raised, I'm sure, many more soldiers, but they had just lost in just three battles over 100,000 of their soldiers and had lost many of their best commanders. Two of the commanders had been defeated there at Cannae. Rome was operating under a system where two leaders would take turns each day running the army. These are some of the reasons why historians say that Rome did not fall, that Carthage did not advance. Another one that I thought of after I'd typed these is some people say, well, it was the defensive situation of Rome. Well, we forget that Hannibal had taken elephants across the Alps. If he can take elephants across the Alps, he could get over a wall. That's not much of a problem for somebody who can carry elephants across the Alps. Truth be told, and I've read a number of historians, you may have as well, none can answer the question why Hannibal did not follow up his victory. I can. God did not let it happen. When we read Scripture, we read about a God who means what He says, and when He prophesies something, it is as good as done. His prophecy will not fail. Why did Hannibal not follow up his victory? Because God did not let it happen. And I would teach you or tell you that what doesn't happen sometimes is just as important as what does when prophecy is concerned. One more slide there, Con. That's why Carthage isn't number five. That's why Carthage was the kingdom that wasn't. Thank you.